Coming up on Simply Superior.
This morning, slick roads led to this seven-car pileup.
And power outages are hitting northwest Wisconsin.
So we all just got hit with the first real storm this season. But out on Park Point, there's a bigger problem. The barrier beach might be eroding away. Then...
read my lips. No new taxes.
That's been a mantra of a certain political party that also claims to be pro-business. But a Superior group says there's one tax they need to grow. And they're hoping to convince lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. Then,
come fly with me, let's fly away.
Maybe you got away for the Thanksgiving holiday, or you picked up relatives who flew in to visit you. Either way, was everyone well behaved on the plane? Those stories coming up after this. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. And welcome to winter weather, though it's officially still fall for the next 3 weeks. As bad as digging out from this season's first snow has been this holiday weekend, snow blowing might be a minor irritant compared to having the ground on your property wash away into the lake. Something like that is happening on Park Point, which holds the distinction of being the world's largest freshwater barrier beach. The Star Tribune ran an article about erosion on Park Point recently, and we decided to take a look into it, as well as what's happening on its counterpart, Wisconsin Point. We'll discuss that with Pam Luagi. She's Duluth Bureau Chief, and can we say Duluth and Superior Bureau Chief?
Sure.
All right. For the Minneapolis Star Tribune, or would that be the Twin Cities Star Tribune?
The Minnesota Star Tribune.
Minnesota Star Tribune. And one of the people that was in the story is also joining us here. John Swenson is professor and associate chair of the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
John Clark Pegg and Lynn Clark Pegg can tell you an awful lot about Park Point because they live there. They are retirees but not retiring personalities. Welcome, John and Lynn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So for John Swenson as a scientist here, I'm going to ask a maybe not scientific question. This is a sandbar, isn't it?
Correct.
Isn't this what sandbars do, erode?
They erode and they construct and they migrate. They're very dynamic features. They're some of the most dynamic features on the Earth's surface.
And so why do we build on them in the first place?
Well, I think it's human nature to get as close to the lake as we can. So that's close.
Pam, what attracted you about, well, first of all, how did you hear there was a story here, and what attracted you to it?
I've been covering this area for a while and noticed that there was a lot of flooding on Park Point a lot the last few years, especially with the high water levels in the lake. And talking to some residents, I'd heard that there was concern about all the erosion and what was going on out there and whether something should be done on a large basis versus individual landowners.
Mm-hmm. And two of those landowners are right here. Is all the land that you thought you owned still there?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, several years ago, the city sold off some tax forfeit lots, and so we have an extra lot behind our house. However, there are consequences of living on Park Point when it comes to water and the weather, and I'm sure we'll get into that.
Well, let's get into it right now. So, I know something about this. This is I'm not going to be quiet. 2012, we had a big flood in Duluth and also Superior. And yep. Tell us how you experienced that.
Well, I think many people on Park Point, for the first time, experienced water in their basements. We bought our home in 2005, and for 7 years, we had a lovely finished basement with wall-to-wall carpeting. In fact, had different people who lived with us. One good friend who was with us for a couple of years lived in the basement. It was a fine place. But with 2012...
And they didn't have to have swimming lessons, right?
No, okay. Not at all. There was a sump pump that went off occasionally. In 2012, we had about an inch of water in our basement, which, you know, it wasn't catastrophic, but there went the wall-to-wall carpeting and a change in the way of viewing our basement. And every year since then, the problem has gotten a bit worse. Part of it is the rising water table, which causes hydrostatic pressure for the water to intrude both from the floor of the basement as well as through the walls.
Lynn, did you know all this when you bought it?
Oh no! I mean, the house was fine. We had no problems with the previous owners because they didn't have to disclose anything.
They didn't have to.
No, and they had never had flooding before. It really was a phenomenon to that house. And the house is over 100 years old, and it's had a basement all those 100 years, and it was habitated. You know, it was okay. It's just the water table came up and didn't go back down. Mm-hmm. When we started digging holes to see where the water was, it was right at or above the floor of our basement. So obviously it wasn't going to work. And we fixed it, and we're very happy with the house. It's now waterproof, and we're okay. But we don't have a finished room for guests anymore. It's a storage space.
I would quickly mention we're also longtime, lifelong sailors. And they talk about...
And now you don't have to go outside,
well,
right?
They talk about a boat being a hole in the water into which you pour money. Well, it turns out living on Park Point can be a similar phenomenon. It's a hole, in our case, in the water because of the water table rising. And so we were constantly pumping it out, as many people are. And if you drive around down on Park Point today, you'll see many places with streams of water coming out of them and running down the street.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about erosion on Park Point, and I think we're talking about Superior, Wisconsin Point, too. You can tell me, John Swinson, if that's correct. And we're inspired. We will not be coy about this either, by a story in the Star Tribune by Pam Luwagie. John Swinson from UMD, is Wisconsin Point the same, suffering the same?
Wisconsin Point is actually in a relatively good position because Wisconsin Point is receiving the sand that historically made its way to Minnesota Point.
Because somebody built the
some
canal?
Folks or? Built some infrastructure, yes. So the presence of the Superior entry breakwaters is really acting to effectively shut off that supply of sediment to Minnesota Point. As a consequence, Wisconsin Point is actually getting wider at about a meter per year. So it's good for you guys.
But there are more houses on Minnesota Point.
Yeah.
So somebody's exactly. Made a mistake there.
Well, yes.
Maybe.
That
goes back to my initial question. Why are people building any kind of infrastructure on, particularly homes, on sandbars? I mean, this is Florida. I'm surprised to hear, John and Lynn, that you have a basement, although I've been to your house, actually, but I didn't think about it. But, I mean, Florida homes don't, right? They mostly have crawl spaces, if that much. You know, how responsible is it, if that's the right word, to be building?
Well, I think
barrier beaches.
I think on human timescales, depending on the system, the sandbar can be relatively stable. And Park Point, I think, historically has been relatively stable. I think now we're starting to see some of the knock-on effects of shutting off the sediment supply, in large part by the Superior breakwaters. But overall, had a pretty good run of houses on Park Point. So,
well, and I think I just comes to my mind that I would say we're also entering a time where we're going into, quote, uncharted waters in terms of the weather and the climate and the severity of the storms. And the jury is out on the lake levels, but it has been at close to or at historic highs for the past couple of years. Usually it goes up, hits those highs, and goes back down again. And, you know, and we have seen that while we've been on the point since 1992. with the lake level rising and going down.
Well, that was my initial question to you. If you have the same amount of land than when you bought it, because if the lake level has risen, then
some,
you have more
some
water.
Homes for sure do not. Mm-hmm. There's clearly land erosion on the lakeside as the from the effects of the strength of the storms and the waves coming in and eroding the sand dunes. Somebody who lives between the S-curve and the bridge said that they have, and they've only owned the house for a few years, they have 20 feet less of dunes
wow.
behind them than when they bought the place.
But do you get a refund on that?
No. That piece of Park Point doesn't have the buffer of the city land on the lakeside because there's before the S-curve, they're straight on to that shoreline, whereas after the S-curve, there's the dunes, which are owned by the city. So if there's any erosion at that point, it's to the city land, not people's property.
John, Peg is referring to, I don't think you actually said the dreaded words climate change, but you hinted pretty closely to him. Mm-hmm. Pam Liwiaji, how do you get people to care? You write, I'm sure you could write stories about climate change all day long. Again, I guess I sort of express it's a sandbar, right? So erosion happens. The sun also rises in the east, right?
Right. And,
you know, but
right. I think there's still a big question about whether climate change is affecting Park Point or whether these are just other issues at play. As you said, the lake goes up and down, and I think a lot of scientists are saying it's going to go back down. The question is far into the future. How will that even out in the end? And if it is higher, then that's definitely going to affect Park Point more. It's Park Point is low-lying, and it's a sandbar.
Mm-hmm. John Swenson, even if the lake goes up and down, erosion is something different, right? I mean, it...
Correct. So when the lake levels rise, that allows the wave environment to basically attack the beach more effectively and cause erosion and sediment transport. So periods of high lake level should expect those periods to be correlated with times of enhanced shoreline erosion and deposition. So it works both ways, but just a more active system.
Deposition meaning?
Deposition like on the upstream to the east of Superior Breakwater. So it's just the system overall becomes more active when lake levels are higher and the wave energy can attack the coast more effectively.
Lynn just said a little while ago, no problems for 100 years or so previously, but we're having 500-year storms every 5 years or no, right?
Correct. I think it's important to realize that there's multiple time scales of processes working here. So on the very longest time scales, there's a gradual rise in lake level that's due to nothing climate-related, everything related to lifting a heavy glacier off of the Earth's surface 10,000 years ago, as crazy as it seems. And that long-term lake level rise is actually what's driving the sort of overall presence of a sandbar and the supply of sediment that feeds that sandbar. Superimposed on that long-term slow rise are decadal scale fluctuations in lake level. That are driven by changes in hydrology. You get periods of increased rainfall, periods of decreased evaporation off the lake for a myriad reasons. And then every year there's an annual cycle. So every year the lake goes up and down by about a foot and a half. Actually, at this time of the year, historically, we've just passed the time of peak lake levels, typically in a year. And now we'll see lake level fall through the winter and into next spring. And then it will recover. So there's these three very distinct timescales all working together. Humans are most impacted by that middle timescale, the decadal timescale, where you see several foot fluctuations in lake level and the attendant effects on coastlines.
And the coastline, if you will, of the two different sides of the point, the more erosion on the lakeside, I would imagine?
Absolutely. More erosion on the lakeside due to just exposure to battering of storms. And on the bay side, or the harbor side, there's just less wave energy. So the erosion over there is more of a nibbling as opposed to a gobbling of material.
But your house,
but the water table on the bay side or harbor side, mm-hmm. More directly impacts people than it does on.
Yes,
on the lake side.
On the bay side, the topography of the sandbar, if you will, is flatter. There's less relief. So and you're closer to lake level overall, and lake level basically sets the base level for the water table. So if you're on the bay side, yes, you're very close to the water table. If you're on the lake side, you may be a bit more perched, and a bit better insulated from that.
I'm still fascinated to learn that Wisconsin Point is different and actually getting larger. Thank you for that knowledge.
Well, it is.
it's a good cocktail party thing to mention to people. Did you know that Wisconsin? What about the South Shore of Lake Superior? Now, I mean, that's a different animal entirely, right? Because it's not a sandbar.
No.
Or is it? You're looking at me and saying,
nope.
"Well,
no, no.
Okay."
No.
How does you know?
So the South
the
Shore.
Lake that, yeah.
No, that's a great question. So the South Shore of Lake Superior, between Superior and let's say up to Port Wing, is largely composed of what's called glacial till, so relatively unconsolidated sediments that erode very easily. With lake level rising, basically. Wave energy is dissipated on that coastline, leads to bluff erosion. If you've spent any time on the South Shore, you've seen dramatic examples of slumping and erosion of the bluffs. All that material is essentially dumped into the lake, and the sand component, it's mostly clay, but there's about 20% sand. All that sand is mobilized by the wind and waves and transported on average to the west. And that is what constructed and what continues to feed what we today call Minnesota and Wisconsin Point.
I see. Okay.
So there's kind of a paradox here. So the lake level rise that is so detrimental is also what feeds the point in the first place on long time scales. So if you insert some breakwaters and shut off that supply of sediment from the South Shore, you are just by definition starving everybody, quote unquote, downstream of that. So everybody on Minnesota Point. So in reality, we have Wisconsin to blame at some level for.
Why did I know this was going to be a Minnesota versus Wisconsin thing? Yes. So what do you do about it?
I think that's a great question. In the short term, what you do about it is you probably nourish the beach, which is what the Corps of Engineers has been doing.
We're talking about now Minnesota Point, Park
That's
Point.
That's correct. You don't have to do anything on Wisconsin Point. You guys are in good shape. on the north side of the pier, you're on the breakwater. You need to – one thing you can do is replace some of that lost sand by taking dredge spoilings and literally pumping them into the near shore. And letting them do their thing.
I know there's dredging down in St. Louis Bay, but there's all kinds of stuff in that dredge, right? From former steel plants and Superfund sites, and so you may not want to put. Lynn and John, what do you think about having a Superfund site?
I had heard about the dredging, and there was the thing about being contaminants, but that'd mm-hmm. be in the harbor, right? That dredging is not so good. But the dredging you're talking about is coming from the bluffs of the South Shore.
Let's clarify that. The dredging I'm referring to is actually coming from the harbor. So that's human dredging of material that's deposited largely by the Nemadji River, where it discharges into the harbor. The material coming
Superior
off
Superior Harbor.
Correct.
Right.
The material coming off the bluffs is pristine, but that's a natural process, and that's what we've interrupted.
Yeah.
Is there? The harbor people will be chasing after me for even saying this, but can you take the breakwaters away?
No comment.
Okay.
I don't think Superior would like that.
No, not the all right.
To a smaller degree, the same thing is happening on the North Shore. John had explained that there is some erosion on the north shore of Lake Superior also feeding Minnesota Point.
That's a good point, Pam, and that's correct. The same processes that are working on the south shore are occurring on the north shore, but just at a greatly reduced rate because the effects of the Duluth shipping canal are much weaker than the effects of the Superior breakwaters just because they're damming a much smaller river of sand, if you want to think of it that way.
So again, what do you do about it for homeowners? Len and John, you are on the
west side.
West side, the bay side, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. But for someone who is facing serious erosion, if you will, on the lake side, what do you do?
Well, I don't know. I see people, some people putting up plywood along the side of the bluff. Other people moving stones in or maybe putting in a concrete barrier. And Lynn and I were walking yesterday on the lake, what used to be the lake walk. There's no longer a walk there. And you can see the boulders that are strewn about. If you actually go down, as many people have done, and watch the power of the lake in a storm with a northeastern gale, Mother Nature is incredibly powerful. And I think in some respects, we need to respect that and learn to work more with Mother Nature. And I don't know what that means exactly, but in the case of a lake walk, maybe you don't put up a boardwalk again, maybe you accept the fact that things are going to constantly be pummeled along that shoreline, and so you don't try to have the view and the access that we've had in the past because of that. Similarly, for homeowners and certainly construction and building of homes, you need to be mindful of the effects of weather and storms and how it can impact you. And people living on a sandbar or oceanfront properties where there are hurricanes. I mean,
right. Going back to Florida, which it leads to, I think a lot of the rest of the country looks at Florida and says, "Well, you know, you are living on a barrier beach. You know, you are living or." There is sympathy, of course, for Katrina in New Orleans, but on the other hand, the area is below sea level.
Absolutely.
So, Pam, what's been the response of your story? You write for a statewide audience. Are there people saying, well, what did they expect, or are they saying they didn't know? Or
certainly there's a little bit of that. There's a question about if there is going to be a more systematic solution to this, who should pay for it? But I think there's also this knowledge that
Wisconsin, apparently, right?
I think there's also a realization, though, that all over the world, people live in places that are desirable to live in, but maybe not the smartest place to live.
Can I give the scientist the last word, John Swenson?
Sure. I think there are actions that can be taken to at least offset some of the beach loss on Park Point. One technique that's often used is armoring, use of boulders to essentially armor the coastline. That is maybe not a great idea at some level because of A, the cost, and B, the fact that oftentimes the armoring really acts to not dissipate the wave energy effectively, rather to transfer it to your neighbor, which is not necessarily a great idea. But there are methodologies to dissipate wave energy and engineering-wise, and to maybe mitigate some of this. But in the long term, I think we do need to appreciate that Park Point is a dynamic feature. We have perturbed it by installing the superior entry breakwaters, and unless we wish to remove those, we face a long-term sediment starvation issue, and we will reap what we sow. And it's not the end of the world. It can be kept at bay, so to speak, but it will cost money.
All right. Thank you, John Swenson, professor and associate chair of the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Minnesota Duluth. We also have with us John Clark Pegg and Lynn Clark Pegg, residents of Park Point, and Pam Luwagie, Duluth Bureau Chief of the Minnesota Star Tribune. Thank you very much, all of you.
Thank you.
Coming up, could a tax help spur business in Superior? And with holiday flyers among us, did anyone do anything on an airplane to be ashamed of? All that after this.
My face above the water. My feet can't touch the ground, and it feels like I can see the sands on the horizon every time you are not around. I'm slowly drifting away.
anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Duluth and Superior have had a long rivalry, with Superior once jostling its neighboring city with the slogan, "Next to Duluth, we're Superior." But now, a business group dedicated to a better Superior is outwardly coveting a tax that Duluth has and Superior doesn't, that they say could help encourage growth. We're joined in the studio by Bruce Thompson of Superior. He's Executive Vice President and Community Bank President for the National Bank of Commerce. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you very much, Robin.
He's got other titles. He's also president of the business group Better City Superior. And in that role, he's looking for ways to encourage local business development. Part of that, I understand, is an exhibition district.
Exposition district, correct.
Pronounce it better than me, right? So tell us what that is.
Well, when we started our searching for solutions to the real issues of turning Superior's economy around, we realized that for the past four decades or so, we'd been really treating symptoms and wanted to get to the root of the problem, which really is that we need more consumption spending in Superior. We need to bring more spending into Superior. And so we did a lot of plans and development and came up with some wants and realized that really the economic development tools to pull that off were not available in Superior. And in particular, as we compete with Duluth, Minnesota, in a complementary fashion, we find that the resources that come from the state of Minnesota to help Duluth are far different than the resources that come from the state of Wisconsin to Superior. So we looked at other types of ideas that had been done in Wisconsin before that we thought we could hybrid and make a small market adaptation of. And we found that the Milwaukee Center District, which is an exposition district, been around for about 25 years, has been very successful there, and it creates an opportunity to have the same type of economic development tools that Duluth already generates and would put us on a more level playing field to generate those types of resources.
So are you really saying Duluth is the golden city on the hill after all?
Well, Duluth has really had
done
quite a renaissance, really. And if you look back to about 1965, when the state of Minnesota helped them get their event center in place, the ADEC, everything grew from that, and it became quite robust. And through that consumption-based spending and creating a better quality of life in Duluth, more attractions, things to come to, they've created quite a draw from the Twin Cities Minneapolis-St. Paul market, which is the spending that is really propelling them put a greater shine on their community and draw more spending.
What's Milwaukee have that you'd like to have?
Well, the Wisconsin...
Other than Milwaukee beer.
Yeah. Well, the Wisconsin Center involves an event center. That's allowable under an exposition district. And the arts are very important within that as well. So that when you create a venue for the arts and you have an event center, you can use those funds for those sort of things. But then what springs up around it is more private development. And you obviously have to have a reason to draw people into town to spend. So it has to be a public-private partnership where you bring multifaceted development into town because you have a place for people to gather.
What sort of enterprise would get funding in Superior? And why wouldn't they have it now? Why wouldn't I want to be free market on you here.
Right.
If I want to build a hotel, I build a hotel, right?
Right. And so what you'll find is that because the DEC has been such a great success in Duluth, and Duluth draws 6 million annual visitors, about 3.5 million of them overnight stays, that fills up hotel rooms. But they only get that because they have activities and they have the DEC booked, you know, year-round for things where people come to gather to be a part of. And then you also have the additional amenities that have been built around there, such as the aquarium, the events that happen, the Grandma's Marathon, all of these great things that draw the Twin Cities client to Duluth. That all creates more opportunity for private investment in other types of activities.
So what would you need government to do here?
Well, see, what happens in Duluth is they are allowed, of course, the hotel lodging, hotel motel tax. They have food and beverage tax, and those dollars roll up to about $12 million annually for Duluth to support many of these activities that may not be self-supporting but are draws nonetheless and bring spending to town. So I was told when we got started in this original process that, well, there's just no way you can have a food and beverage tax in Wisconsin. It doesn't exist. Well, we found out that if you have an position district, you can. And the current food and beverage tax in Duluth, 2.25%, on top of what is now 8% sales tax, creates almost an 11% tax on prepared food and beverage, not purchased in a grocery store, but prepared food and beverage.
At a restaurant, right.
Right, so at a restaurant. So that revenue source doesn't exist on this side of the bridge. Be it we as citizens, when we go to Duluth, we always pay it, and we don't think anything of it because it's part of the bill, and it's insignificant relative to the bill. And so we do have a hotel lodging tax in Superior that's actually a little higher than Duluth, but our sales tax is much less.
You're making me, I know there's people who say you buy certain things in Superior, you buy certain things in Duluth. So as I'm trying to follow you, I think, okay, I want to stay the night in Duluth, but I'm going to go to a restaurant in Superior to avoid taxes. But it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. In fact, you'll find that a lot of times if you compare the hotels, if you get the same hotel in Duluth and Superior, you know, yes, the tax would be 1% higher on the lodging side of it, but the sales tax less, so the overall tax rate a little bit less, but the room rate is much different in Duluth. It's much higher. And yet Duluth still fills first because that's where people want to be.
And you don't think that the quality of a Superior is inferior?
Not
right?
at all. Not right. at all. And I think there's a real opportunity for us to complement Duluth and make this whole region stronger, draw more people up, because there's some things that are missing as far as places to play and do things up here that don't exist in Duluth right now, but maybe larger markets are accustomed to, like the Twin Cities or Milwaukee. And if we had those options up here, and one of the big things we want to do is bring a large indoor tournament play facility to Superior where it would be turfed, where you could do multiple soccer games at the same time, lacrosse, indoor softball, things like that, where we can bring youth sports and tournament play up from the Twin Cities up here, that which fills hotel rooms, has more spending in restaurants, and more spending in general at retailers, and it doesn't exist in the market. There is not an indoor facility where you can do year-round type things like this in the market.
On the Superior side?
Well, in the whole market.
Okay. Well, what about Clyde Iron? I think
Clyde Iron is a smaller venue, but you can't bring tournament play, large-scale tournament play up here with just one facility like that.
So what would an example of that kind of tournament play be?
Well, we're talking about youth soccer.
Okay.
You know, all the way up through the probably the 17-18 year range. We just proved last year we didn't do it ourselves, but we saw it happen in Superior, where we hosted our first AAU basketball tournament only because we have the facilities to do it now. When you consider the fact that our brand new high school has not only a court to play their main games on, but they have several courts in addition to that. So when you put together the courts that we have at our middle school and our high school and our university, we now have enough basketball courts to host a tournament. Well, the very first time out of the gate, we had 90 teams from three states come to Superior, experience things in the entire region, but for 2 days, that was almost 3,000 people. And what we found from those people, they were blown away by the quality of the facilities. Of course, we had a great weekend of weather, too, so they got to explore the area a little bit.
You were personally able to arrange that, right?
I was not, but I'm always happy when that happens because I'm a lifelong resident. And I know how it can be.
Any time of the year, any day, right. Out of the blue.
But yes. at least, you know, this is an indoor thing, right. And we try to do things indoors so that we can be more year-round. And so all of a sudden now for next year, those teams all want to come back. And we're going to be up to probably 120 teams from four states because Iowa is sending a bunch of teams up now. And it's because we had great facilities.
Let's finish out the commercial. So what's this called exactly and what time of year is it?
Well, this was Playmakers North hosted an AAU basketball tournament.
Okay.
And it was the first one that we've tried up here. And it happened because of the hard work of the leadership of Playmakers North AAU. And it was just a great success because, again, of the great facilities we had. And it happened to happen at the end of June. Mm-hmm. And that's when their AAU season is, you know, the summer months. So
AAU is what ages?
It's a variety of ages. I think it's as early as about fifth grade up through high school.
great. We're talking to Bruce Thompson. He's the Executive Vice President and Community Bank President for National Bank of Commerce, and he's here today as President of Better City Superior, which is looking for an exhibition.
Exposition district.
Why can't I pronounce
it's called
that?
A Superior. we're trying to get a Superior Exposition District carved out of existing Wisconsin state law, and we have two bills, and we've had the hearing before the Assembly Ways and Means Committee, and we're getting a hearing scheduled before a Senate committee in hopes that the legislature will and the governor will understand that this permission that we're asking for will help us generate internally the types of revenue streams that can help us create new assets in Wisconsin that will complement Duluth, make Superior stronger, draw people into Superior.
Sounds like a great pitch. So who could possibly be against it?
Well, initially, we started out with public hearings. I did live public Facebook and live sittings. We did three professionally run focus groups. We did a countywide survey. I spoke to groups as small as 5 up to 600 with regard to this. And the main question that comes up is regard to, well, this is a tax. Well, what we're proposing is a 0.5% tax on prepared food and beverage, so a nickel for every $10 spent on prepared food and beverage, and an increase in the hotel lodging tax that will go specifically for cash flow to retire bonding, which would help create these new assets. So we're not asking anybody to support something that's not going to bring new assets to town and drive new revenues to town. But the objections that came early on was, well, I can't afford 5 cents more on a $10 purchase. And we can respect that, but you also got to consider that this is prepared food and beverage. So my counter to that is, it's
meaning, it's restaurant food or which you go out.
It is a choice. Right. So it is a choice. It's not a mandated thing. It's a choice. And if you were to go and get a sandwich at a sandwich shop and spend $10, it is true you would spend $10.05. However, if you were to go to your local grocery store and spend $10 to buy enough sandwich material to make 5 sandwiches, you wouldn't pay it. So it is a logical choice. And so it's not punitive to those that can't afford it. It's a choice. And in the end, we hope to bring more people to town. In my lifetime, we've lost 6,000 people in this town, and that's 6,000 taxpayers. And people wonder why taxes are high. It's because there's less folks around to pay the taxes and costs go up. We've got to drive growth and get more taxpayers into town. Ultimately, we hope by creating these resources and these assets that draw spending to town, we can make our community a higher quality community, make it more advantageous to live here, draw more people in, spread the burden amongst others, and work on creating overall a quality community.
In real numbers, what do you think it would net?
Well, our goal is, as far as the exposition district, is that spending, and this is calculated by the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. They looked at the sales tax for the community and what this would create. And we could probably support about $12 to $14 million worth of bonding from this revenue stream. That's pretty predominantly the existing revenue stream. We're going to draw more spending into town, so we probably could afford more. But if we can piece together $12 million there, perhaps Opportunity Zone funding, TIFs, could, along with private development funding, could get us up to $30, $40, $50 million worth of resources to create some really new, cool things in Superior.
Mm-hmm. I asked who could possibly be against it. Even though it's only a nickel on $10, it might be an important nickel for a restaurant because this is what they do. This is their price just went up. How are restaurants thinking about this?
Well, yeah, we had to fully explain the whole idea to the restaurant. We are now supported by the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. We got support from the restaurants in Superior. You might be surprised that many of the restaurant owners in Superior also have restaurants in Duluth. And all things being equal, they would say that because the dollars are used to drive more events and centers of activity to Duluth, that their restaurants grow and do better in Duluth than they do in Superior. So the nickel on their product is not significant to them because the quality of their product is the same, and yet they still do better when people spend 22.5 cents more in Duluth than the 5 cents in Superior.
So the worst case scenario, what if you don't get this?
Well, we continue to forge on. We've been working on this for 7 years as far as the development process, about 4 years through the Wisconsin legislature, and we really believe we're on to a really cool idea. I think it fits perfectly for Superior with our relationship with Duluth, and we believe that we won't fail, and we want to get this done to some extent. Otherwise, we would be saddled with trying to create assets with less tools. Might be the Opportunity Zone Fund, which is something that's new since last year. And we do have Opportunity Zone from Belknap Street all the way to the waterfront. So the downtown is in the Opportunity Zone. There's funding that could come from that. There is some TIF money still available. And then the City of Superior could bond to help public-private partnerships to create these venues. But that creates a debt burden on the municipality. Our idea has no municipality liability, is all private.
Mm-hmm. And again, who is against this?
Well, the Hotel and Lodging Association, National Hotel Lodging and the Wisconsin Hotel Lodging Association, always objects anytime there's being a cost added on to their product. Now, we all know if you go somewhere, a high tourism area,
there are all kinds of costs
added
on.
There's fees added right. on. There's fees added on. They don't call them tax, but there are fees added on that make the – and people pay them because they're going there for the experience. So I get it.
The latest one I've seen is resort fee,
yeah.
which doesn't show up on your orbits or your Travelocity
right.
until you get there.
That's right. I had that exact experience.
Yeah,
I went to Las
fun,
Vegas.
Aren't they?
Yeah. And it was a prepaid thing, and everything was prepaid, right, until you get to the desk and they say – oh, well, it'll be a $15 a day resort fee.
And the word resort has a broad definition,
it
apparently.
Sure does.
Because
yeah,
it
was a hotel.
Right.
It was a hotel.
Right.
But, it you know, I understand
but
it.
But so that makes me, you know, the obvious thing, if I may not dance around the elephant in a room, that
sure.
would be Republicans, right, who are not big fans of taxes.
Right.
So can it be called a fee or something? What
you nope.
know, what does it take to no?
No,
what,
I don't think
well, I meant
can,
in order to pass it.
No, I we're not we've been very transparent about
okay.
all of this. My contention is that all tax is not bad. Wasteful tax we can all agree on. There's varying degrees of what people consider waste, obviously. And we all want to live in as low a tax environment as we can, but we all know there are social responsibilities that taxation supports. In our case, we want to make this community healthier so that the mandated taxation can support the basic needs and so that the consumption-based taxation creates new things and growth. And
basic needs being social welfare,
right,
things to
right.
help people cannot help themselves.
Yes,
right.
right. And it isn't
and,
it
and
isn't
growth being all the great stuff you're talking about.
Right, and it isn't uncommon that legislation gets passed bipartisan that throws lots of tax increment, consumption tax increment at major projects. It happens. And it,
there's
it,
something it, called, a little company, I think
I've
it's
heard of
called
it.
Fox something, Foxtrot.
I thought you might bring that up, Foxconn.
Or Congain.
Yeah.
No.
We hope it's all a beautiful thing in the end.
And I think it has something to do
end,
with the Republican,
yeah,
too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, it you can't say you
we
don't.
We love Foxconn.
You can't
in
say
fact,
you
bring,
don't.
Come up here.
Right. Well, it seems like, you know, you can't ignore the fact that all of this great public-private partnership development that's happened over the years has always involved some level of commitment from the communities. And in our case, this is a local issue. We're not asking the state for anything. In fact, the state budget office did the calculation of what it would cost to do this for Superior. And administratively, a one-time $20,000 for us to create $12 to $15 million worth of bonding capacity that can be used for economic development. So $20,000 is, you know, probably a bit of a drop in the bucket, and it's a one-time thing. But the other thing the state gets back from it is they'll get the extra 5% sales tax on all the additional spending that happens in Superior, which otherwise would not happen. So they'll get a return on this investment, which is really nothing. We didn't go down there with our hands out. We went down there with a plan and with an idea that the community backed
down to Madison
that would say all you got to do is give us a permission to do this. That'll help us level the playing field with our neighbor. They're already doing the heavy lifting of getting 6 million people to 5 minutes from our doorstep. You know, we can grow the Wisconsin economy with this, and with very minimal investment from the state.
Great. Sounds like a win-win argument. And if somebody has the other side and wants to argue that, give us a call. Join
very
us.
Good.
Don't try to call us on the air. We don't work that way.
Okay.
But thanks, Bruce
All
Thompson,
right.
for joining us. He is the president of Better City Superior. Coming up, with holiday travel or any time, do you know the proper etiquette on a plane? We'll hear from an expert after this.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So is holiday travel time, and for that we've dug back into the archives a bit for a discussion of airplane etiquette, or more directly, passenger shaming. My Wisconsin Public Radio colleague John Munson and I were introduced to the idea back in 2015 from the woman who coined the term and the website and social media pages by the same name. Here's our conversation with the Sassy Stew about passenger shaming.
Robin, you fly a lot. Ever hit the bar in old Bombay?
What happens in Bombay stays in Bombay, but that one's still on my bucket list. But you might think twice before ordering too many drinks on a plane these days. Bad behavior is being caught on camera and is showing up on the website Passenger Shaming. Joining us is the woman behind the shaming, Sean Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, what is passenger shaming?
Passenger shaming is a fun website that allows you as the passenger to call out some really disgusting behavior via a photograph.
Now, you're also known as the Sassy Stew.
Yes, the Sassy Stew came about 7 years ago. It's called Rants of a Sassy Stew, as a stewardess. Just a real popular blog about me ranting about passengers.
Right. At that time, were you still working for the airline?
I was.
And how did they take to the sassiness?
They fired me.
Gee, yeah, I'm really surprised to hear that.
I know, it's shocking, especially because even to this day, I've never named where I work, but, you know, hey, they weren't digging it, and now, you know what? It worked out for me.
So, it's gone viral with passengers. How many deputies do you have?
I get so many photographs now from passengers because they don't want to sit next to these people, you know? Let's see. On Instagram, we have over 250,000 followers. On Facebook, we have like 330,000 or 340,000. So, it's pretty popular.
I've got it caught up on your Facebook page, and I see someone's feet with no socks on.
Right. So, yeah, you'll get a lot of feet, especially the ones that don't have socks or shoes on in inappropriate places, such as on your armrest right next to your elbow. You'll see them up on headrest. You'll see dirty diapers in the seat back pocket.
Man, I don't want to fly on that airplane.
Oh, well, it's on every airplane. People change their babies on the tray tables. I hate to tell you guys that.
So we've got dirty diapers. We've got bare feet. Any other body parts?
Bare chest. One of my favorites is a guy sitting there, no shirt on. And then he has the pillowcase over his head as far as it will go, which just covers his eyes. We have good snoring video, good slobbering videos, you know, stuff like that. I think people tend to forget that they're on, keyword, public transportation, not, you know, your own private jet. Oh, another huge one are people who sit in this any seat with a bulkhead in front of them and put their legs up on the bulkhead.
I'm guilty. Guilty right here.
That's very shameful. I'm kidding. They're probably in the galley going, oh my God, look at that lady. She's serious right now, right?
So let me ask you here. I don't see in the seat back card or the instructions that are given to us verbally anything saying not to take off your shoes or socks. Now, I will admit, true confession time for me, I've never taken off my socks. However, I have taken off my shoes.
You're the guy.
Hey, if your feet don't smell, I'm totally okay with that because you know what? On many airlines and you're flying first class, they'll pass out slippers or socks or something to wear. that's fine.
All right. On the other hand, there's behavior that people know is inappropriate. And there's this thing that we all know called the Mile High Club.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The Mile High Club seems to have an attraction to the lavatory, which I don't see anything remotely attractive about that, but at least that's somewhat private.
Right.
Am I to understand by some of the pictures on the site that people have actually joined a club in their seats?
Absolutely.
They're gymnasts.
Yeah.
Two gymnasts, I guess.
I mean, you kind of have to be in the lavatory, too, because, you know, who can fit in there just one person? Yes, they're disgusting. I mean, that's not water on the floor, you know? Like, it's gross. One of my biggest pet peeves and a lot of flight attendants' pet peeves are when we're sitting on the ground waiting for the passengers to board. Oh, there's that beautiful, spacious, clean bathroom in the terminal. No, can't use that. Got to board the plane and come use the lavatory immediately.
There's a video clip on your Facebook page that is really pathetic. These two people are trying to get the attention, apparently, of the pilot of an aircraft that's about to take off. We have some audio from this. You get the play-by-play here. This is from the passenger shaming Facebook page. So they're asking for the door to be opened. It's closed. Clearly, they've been they have ignored all the calls to show up. Their name has probably been called on the loudspeaker. You know, you're in the airport.
Passenger Smith, please report to gate 7A. We're ready to get the heck out of Dodge, and you're holding up the works.
You know, I mean,
right? People will literally be sitting, you know, 30 feet from the gate agent and or the door, and they just I don't get it. I don't. So, you know, unfortunately for that couple and pretty much anybody else in that situation, that's the point of no return. They're not coming back.
I felt really bad for them on the one hand. On the other hand, mm-hmm. I thought, what was your expectation there?
No, I thought it was funny. I'm a horrible person, though. So there's that.
Shaming seems to be a real trend. I mean, we have food shaming. We have, I don't know, pick a noun and then attach the word shaming to it. How do you feel about that?
I think shaming works. I've had numerous people contact me privately and on the Facebook page that said, oh, my God, I used to do XYZ. Thank you for showing me this because I will never do it again. I had no idea I looked like this. I think shaming is the way to go.
Well, thank you so much. Our guest has been Sean Kathleen, also known as the Sassy Stew, who runs a couple of websites about passenger shaming. You can tell us where to find them, yes?
Sure. The most active places that I post are on Facebook, so you can search Rants of a Sassy Stew and Passenger Shaming on Facebook, and we're also on Instagram, which is really popular, too.
Great.
Call anytime. There's a great
shame on you.
That was John Munson and me in our 2015 conversation with the Sassy Stew. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Enjoy the rest of the holiday weekend.